Here we go. And thank you for coming to Jew of the Future Week 3. Must an artificial intelligence observe Shabbat? Before we take care of artificial intelligence, just some intelligence of our own. Please, 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 if you could silence your cell phones, that would be great. As well, if you are not receiving the emails for these classes with the source sheets in advance of the class, it means you're not on the email list for the class. Please see me afterwards, give me your email address, and that way you will get the follow-up email from today, which includes a link for the audio recording, and you will also get the source sheets in advance of next week, assuming I have them ready in advance of next week, which I expect to, but you never know. I'm glad to say the topic is set for the first series of the year at Beth Emeth. God willing, it will be September 11th and 18th. And our topic will be Jonah, More Than a Fish Story. We'll be doing the themes from the book of Jonah. It's appropriate. It's read as the Haftorah on Yom Kippur at Mincha. And its themes are very associated with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So that'll be September 11th and 18th. Also, we are planning here in this building a day of learning on Sunday, September 8th. With half-hour classes running from 9 a.m. until 5:30 p.m. They will be on the High Holidays and Sukkot. We'll be having classes on history, Tanakh, the liturgy, philosophy, all surrounding those holidays. More information coming as soon as I have more information. But that's what we have right now. But that'll be Sunday, September 8th, and that'll be a free program. A full day of learning, or just come for half an hour, whatever you like.
Like
what we did in December, except that was a Tanakh one, this is a holidays one. We're still trying to come up with a good title for the program. If anyone has ideas, I'd be glad to hear it. Okay, but not right now. On a serious note, the learning this morning will be for a refuah shlema, a speedy recovery for Mindel Bat Yehudit. Who's a regular within the class. Okay. Our topic this morning, the artificial intelligence topic. So the first thing you have to do if you're going to talk about artificial intelligence is define what exactly artificial intelligence is. Anyone want to take a stab at that? What is artificial intelligence? Don't go there. Don't go there. Because that's just going to invite responses. And no. Please don't go there. Robots. Okay, yeah. Sorry, there was a hand there. I heard robots.
Algorithms.
Oh, boy. Problem-solving programs. Sorry?
Non-human.
Part of the artificial, we assume, is non-human, although we'll have to talk about that. There are seats. There are a couple of seats over there still. What else? Yeah, Linda. Computer thinking, okay. We're all sort of working around certain elements here. It is clearly artificial, right? Made by something, we assume human beings, because we figure we're the only ones who can create them. I'm not giving enough credit to the dolphins and the mice. They are machines which are able to make deductions and initiate actions. And when I say actions, I don't mean a particular, action that a robot is able to move in a certain direction or something like that. But the point is, when we talk about artificial intelligence, we mean it is a machine. In other words, it's something that we created, and it is intelligent in the sense that it is able to interpret data, to come to conclusions from that. And then I'm adding, maybe it's not necessary for it, but it is able to take action based on the data and the deductions it made. You could argue that action piece is not necessarily relevant. It's more about making the deductions. But the question that we have to address is, how does that intersect with Shabbat for our specific purpose, but more broadly, is this considered life? Can an AI, an artificial intelligence, be considered Jewish? Is that possible? And what kind of responsibilities does that place on me? Ian?
What if it wasn't mentioned?
Yeah.
If you develop a level of consciousness.
So I'm deliberately avoiding consciousness because I don't know what consciousness is. Meaning, you could define consciousness as awareness of itself. You could, you know, present that. That's how some do define it. But that can be a very simple and straightforward sort of mechanism. That doesn't have to connote a level of sophistication. I think we usually mean more than that when we say consciousness. Is feeling consciousness? Oh, feeling like that. Sensitivities. Maybe. I don't know. Yeah.
Love.
Oh, boy. And that, because you can rule out a whole bunch of human beings. Yeah.
Theoretically, a programmer puts in all the parameters on what Judaism and sets the stage for moving in that direction. One could actually attribute to that, Bagola, basically, that it was Jewish because of the consciousness of Judaism that was programmed into it.
That's a really interesting idea. If it is programmed with Judaism in it, with the ideas of Judaism, it's going to follow the rules of Judaism, could that make it a Jew? No. Why not? Sorry? Well, because it's not very Jewish. That's not very Jewish. But somebody who is programmed to perform the commandments, that's not really Jewish. Judaism is supposed to be about me choosing. It's about covenant. It's about free will. So I would argue that being programmed actually makes it the least Jewish Jew in the room. I mean, there's something to be said about it. I don't mean to be glib about it, but let's go a little bit further with this, because I don't want to spend so much time on our definition that we don't get to our topic. But what I want to do is clearly delineate what I am talking about and what I'm not talking about. There's a topic that is gaining a lot of discussion in observant Jewish circles these days about use of machines like Google Home, Amazon Alexa, where you walk into the house and you say something, or it's even just aware that you walked into a room and it's able to do things on your behalf. Is that a problem on Shabbat? My friend and colleague Rabbi Ziering taught a class last year on this topic, and he pointed out that they now have mind-controlled drones. And you can do that. I Google that, and you'll find it. You'll find that there's a group of grad students in Edmonton who actually created mind-controlled drones. They're working on it on weekends, and you know there's video of this. You can watch it on YouTube. Well, then the question is: so then, if I can use my mind to turn on the lights, is that now okay on Shabbat? Because I turned it on just with my thoughts. So those are interesting questions, but they're not really our point. Because those are questions about what constitutes a deed as far as the laws of Shabbat are concerned. Does thought count? Does speech count? And that's interesting. But what we're talking about is not where you are engaged in an action. The point is, the machine is engaged in the action. The AI is engaged in the action. You didn't tell it anything. What we are talking about is, If someone succeeds in creating artificial intelligence where the machine itself decides on its own, it's Saturday morning, it's 8 a.m., 8:30, 9 o'clock, 7 o'clock, whatever time it is that the AI has observed that the residents of the house tend to get up in the morning, and therefore it wants to turn on the light on their behalf. Does it need to observe Shabbat? Or, let's go further. An AI gets trained to find satisfaction, whatever satisfaction means, in particular activities. It is trained to enjoy whatever enjoy means, certain activities. It decides that participating in the synagogue is an enjoyable activity because it sees that people do it. It sees that it reads studies about the beneficial effects of participating in religious services, and it decides that it's going to go to the synagogue. Let's say it's, I don't know, 13 years old. Does it get a bar mitzvah? Does it count for a minyan? In all seriousness, how do you deal with questions like this? Take a look at source number one, article in Tablet, November of 2017. Can a robot be Jewish? So she interviews a few rabbis. So one of them is this Rabbi Jack Abramowitz. I'd certainly be a lot quicker to offer robots citizenship than I would be to offer them religion. He says that because this article was in the wake of Saudi Arabia granting citizenship to an artificial intelligence, or one in training, so to speak, that was brought to a conference in Saudi Arabia. So as a stunt, they said, we're granting it citizenship, and it's the first robot citizen of a country. So he says, I'd be quicker to give it citizenship than religion, said Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, who has written about artificial intelligence for the Orthodox site Jew in the City. If they are determined to be intelligent and aware and able to feel and suffer, they should enjoy the same rights we would give to anybody. I want to come back to that in a little bit. Both rabbis, because they interviewed a couple of them, are skeptical of the concept of a Jewish robot, citing the need for moral discernment. Even if they have intelligence, it doesn't mean they have a soul, which is basically the foundation of religion. It's a spiritual obligation rather than a physical one, Abramowitz explained. And then they go on to, Emma Davis goes on to talk about a rabbi, Mark Goldfeder, who at the time was at the Department of Law and Religion at Emory University. And she writes, 3 years ago, Rabbi Mark Goldfeder sparked controversy for suggesting that a robot could be counted in a minyan. Today he stands by his opinion, arguing that, quote, there's no requirement for members of the quorum to be flesh and blood Jews. Insert joke here. He believes that if the soul is the ability to tell right from wrong and that drives you to a greater spiritual ability, then sure, you can easily program a soul. Now, mind you, I went back to Rabbi Goldfeder's original article, and that's not what he said. This is a case of yellow journalism. Go back and read it. You can find his article online. I didn't put it here, but it was a JTA piece. Should robots count in a minyan? Rabbi talks Turing test. Anyone familiar with the Turing test? The Turing test is the test suggested by Turing, the computer programmer, that in the event that you're able to program a machine to have a dialogue with a human being and convince the human being that it's actually human, it has passed the test of being a true artificial intelligence. If it can fool people into thinking that it is human. Again, insert joke here. We could just do this all day. But the point is that that's our question here. Our question is, can an artificial intelligence be Jewish? And how does Judaism view life? And then, along with that, we're also going to need to discuss how Judaism views Shabbos, or Shabbat, depending on how you pronounce it. But how do we view Shabbat? Because I am going to come to the conclusion, spoiler for the first half hour, that it's not in fact Jewish, and it's not in fact considered alive. However, it is still able to initiate activity. That was part of our definition of artificial intelligence. And the question will still be, if I have one in my home, is there any reason why I need to keep it from doing whatever it wishes to do on Shabbat? So that's where we have to go with this. We have a lot to cover. I'm not going to be able to take every question. I want to take some of the questions and have some dialogue, you know, to the extent possible. You were going to say?
I was just curious the difference between, like, setting a timer.
Good. And that is indeed one of the questions. The question was asked, what will be the difference between that and setting a timer? Right? We use timers all the time, so to speak. Timers are a very old controversy in Judaism. Interestingly, the first response that I'm aware of on setting a timer on Shabbat was actually for coffee. And it goes back to the 19th century. Early 19th century. Now, you'll ask me, what in the world, what kind of timer was that? And the answer was a really, really, really long fuse. I'm not joking. It was a slow-burning material, and they would set up the fuse before Shabbat, and that way they'd be able to have their coffee. They go figure. Some people do anything for fresh coffee. So, let's get started. I saw more hands, but let's jump into this. So our first question has to be, does an artificial intelligence have mitzvot, have commandments? So I heard already from a few people before we got started, they remembered the topic of the golem. So take a look at source number two, which is basically your first mainstream Jewish source that that discusses the golem. Rava created a man. Just in case, you're wondering. One day, on Tuesday, he took a shower. On Wednesday, he created a man. On Thursday, he went out to a restaurant. It's taken as a given, it's Talmudically, that this can happen. No one reads the story and, no one Talmudically hears the story and says, wait a minute, how did that happen? No, of course, Rava created a man. It involved a book called Sefer Yetzirah, which is a Kabbalistic work that is very, very old, and is supposed to have within it the secrets of Yetzirah, of creation. So Rava created a man and sent him before Rabbi Zerah. Rabbi Zerah spoke to him, but he didn't respond. Rabbi Zerah said, "You must be from the magicians. Return to your dust." And so that is what happened. It can't speak. Rabbi Zerah reduces it to dust. Why isn't that an act of murder? Because it wasn't a person. Why isn't it a person? Because it can't speak. Why is speech somehow the definition of life? What does that mean? People who are mute are not alive now? Yeah.
If it comes from flesh and blood, that's the definition of...
Didn't come from flesh and blood, but that's not what he said. Right? He said it can't speak.
The question was, why isn't it murder? And I'm saying because it didn't come from flesh and blood.
Right.
A la the meat that doesn't come from animals, same issue. If it doesn't come from the source that you're talking about.
Right. I have to do a brief digression. On that. The meat that doesn't come from animals, because I was actually in the States earlier this week and I went to a restaurant where they had the Impossible Burger and I've wanted to try one, but they only sell them for restaurants and getting one in a kosher restaurant isn't something you can get here. So I was so excited and I had to get it to go. So I got it to go, put it in the box, and the person I was with was getting grilled cheese. And so we get to where we're going and we open up the boxes and I open up the box and I think, oh, that must be your grilled cheese. Why? Because, first of all, it's on toasted multigrain bread instead of a hamburger bun. So I said, it must be the grilled cheese. No, it wasn't. It turned out to be the Impossible Burger. But then they put salad dressing on it. And I thought, you're giving it away. You're supposed to be pretending that it's meat. If you put salad dressing on it, everyone's going to know it's a vegetable. Why did you do that? I didn't understand. And I never thought about ordering a burger and saying, hold the salad dressing. It wasn't bad. But I couldn't tell if it was like a hamburger because it had salad dressing and it was on multi-grain sliced bread instead of a bun. So, memo to restaurants, don't do that. Okay, sorry. I'm sorry. Going back to your main point. Yes, it's not from flesh and blood, and we're going to come back to that. But why are you giving speech as your barometer? So you could say, you could suggest that talking about speech is because it's about demonstrating intelligence. The Talmud has a class of human being called a cheresh. A cheresh originally meant somebody who was deaf and mute, and Talmudically was considered to be non-bardat, to be somebody who doesn't demonstrate intelligence. Yes, clearly that's not true. So some took it as, not we're saying that they are unintelligent, but that because in an age when you didn't have Helen Keller's type of schools, you didn't have the ability to train people, they had no way to discern what is the person's level of intelligence, and so the assumption was that in fact there is no intelligence. This has become a topic of very fascinating discussion over the last few hundred years, because of course people are fully functional and intelligent and so forth. And so, how do you deal with the Talmudic passages on it is an interesting question. But you could say it's simply about demonstrating intelligence. And they say this being isn't able to speak, therefore I assume it not to be intelligent, but then that wouldn't be grounds for murder. Right? So let's say he tests it and he says it can't speak, so it's not intelligent. That doesn't justify ending its life. So there's something else going on. If you take a look at source number three, this will be familiar for those who were at the course that we did a few months ago at Beth Emeth, the Kabbalah of Mitzvot. So we talked about Kabbalah and speech in the second session in that series. And I noted this source there, source number three. In Genesis, in Bereshit, chapter 2, sentence 7, we are told that God breathed life into the nostrils of the human being. Vayipach be'apav nishmat chayim. He breathed the nishmat chayim. Literally, you could take that as the breath of life, or, as is taken here, the neshama, the soul of life. Onkelos is an Aramaic translation slash commentary to the biblical text. It is extremely old. You're talking about a couple of thousand years old, back to the time when that was the way people learned Chumash. They learned biblical text by reading the Hebrew and then reading an Aramaic translation slash commentary. So look what he says. And he breathed in his nostrils the neshama of life, and it was in man a speaking spirit. The original Hebrew, nefesh chaya, which I would have translated as a living spirit, but Onkelos translates it as ruach memalala, a speaking spirit. In other words, life and speech are equated. And we see that in Midrash and in the Zohar, a classic, source number 4. You were all warned about this as children. To what was Amos the prophet referring when he said that God is the former of mountains, creator of the wind, who tells a person his speech? That's a verse from Amos. This was specifically a reference to God's praise and might. When God decides to create a person, he decrees how many conversations that person will have, how many things he will say, and he quotes you a verse from King David. In other words, all the things that you're going to say, all the words you have, are already figured in from the beginning. So use them wisely. You only have a certain number. You've heard that, right? People heard that as children. So this is the source for it, it appears. But my point here is the idea that is emphasized here is God's attention to the speech of a human being. The Zohar, in source number 5, even the breath of the mouth has a place and position. God does with it what he does. Even a person's word, even a person's voice is not for nothing. All have a place and position. Speech is critical. One last source, in source number 6, links the different aspects of a person's... Yeah. Oh, no, I forgot to warn you. I'm sorry. Do me a favor, Morris. Just grab those. I forgot to warn people. I added some sources this morning. I have a few more here. Yes, and all the good people who printed, even though I sent it so late, are now out of luck. So, yes, here are some more. I'm going to, when I send the follow-up email from the session... When I send the follow-up email from the session, I will include the new version of the source sheets. I apologize. I realized this morning that I wanted more material on there, and my fault. My bad. I'm looking around, and people are perplexed. And it's a good thing when you print it out. That's what we want to have happen. Okay. Sorry. But source number 6, Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin. I mean, for anyone who didn't get a new version because we ran out, the only sources that I added are sources 3 through 6. So we're up to the last one. After that, it's all going to be the same as it was. So don't panic. Your sheets are still worthwhile. But Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin in the Nefesh HaChaim, in source number 6, associates different aspects of pronouncing words with different aspects of the soul. And I'm not going into the specifics of it now, because that's not really our focus. But what Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin says, based on the Zohar, is when you pronounce a word, the letters of it, the vowels, the musical notes, in biblical text, the letters have notes. Those are all related to different aspects of the soul. When you speak, you are activating and using different parts of your spirit, so that what we're seeing here is that Judaism sees speech as more than just something that demonstrates intelligence. It's tied into our core identity. It's tied into our neshama. It's tied into our soul. It's part of what God uses to animate human beings in the first place. That's the idea here. And so he says, well, this golem can't do that. It has no power of speech. It has no soul, is the argument that he's trying to make. However, that just pushes our question. Because that may have been true for Rava's golem. And that may be true for the state of artificial intelligence even now. But what happens 10 years from now? What happens when you create one that actually can come up with speech that can fool human beings into thinking that it's another human being? Right? There was a device a couple of years ago that actually fooled some people, although there were some questions about that particular trial. But you know, will we then say that is indeed a human being? And here we come back to what you said before about not being born of human beings. Because our approach really is that speech is taken as, to use the Hebrew terms, a siman, not a siba. Hebrew speakers, what is a siman? A sign. What is a siba?
Reason.
A reason, a cause. Speech is a sign of, at the end of the day, of having a soul, but it isn't the cause of it. Such that even if you come up with a machine that is able to generate human speech with a full creativity and everything else, that will not mean that we will consider it to be alive. And one of the pieces of evidence that's brought for it is source number 7. For those who don't have the new sheets, that is source number 3. Rabbi Tzvi Ashkenazi, in the response of Chacham Tzvi, he was a remarkable thinker. He is really deserving of his own session to discuss him. But but he says, I was uncertain about the status of a man created via Sefer Yetzirah, this Kabbalistic work that apparently could be used to create life. Do we say, he's asking about a minion, since the Torah says, and I will be sanctified among the children of Israel. That's one of the core texts involved in prayer and a minyan. God says, I will be sanctified among the children of Israel. B'nei Yisrael. So he's not included. He's not a child of Israel. Or perhaps, since the Talmud says, one who raises an orphan in his home is considered as though he had birthed him. We talked about that last week with adoption. Since this man was created by the righteous, he is included in the children of Israel. The deeds of the righteous are their children. Would you be willing to say that? And he says, no, because Rabbi Zeira killed this this creature. So clearly the creature cannot be considered as one who would have been able to participate in a minyan, because then they would have kept him around. Because you know the times when you're waiting for a death. So look, you can create a whole minyan out of them and just store them there. And that'll be your guarantee that you always have a minyan. So the point here is, his standard is B'nai Yisrael, being born of Jews. Because he's talking about minyan, that's why Jews. But being born of a human being is what makes one a human being. Now, as a side note, there is a question that you still need to ask, which we're not going to be able to go through here, but was really forced by number one, so it's number one about citizenship, which is, if an AI is programmed for feelings in some way, now, what that exactly means is a good question, but it's much discussed already in the literature, the ethics of programming a machine to fear, you know, death, to fear disassembly. So the question then is, if it has a certain level of fear or an experience of pain, whatever that means, is there then a prohibition in Judaism to do anything that causes it fear, that causes it pain? We have laws about not causing pain to others. We have laws about not causing pain to animals. Will you apply that to the case of the AI? I'm not sure. It's a very interesting question. If we had more than an hour, we would spend time on it. We're not going to, because again, we don't. But I want to make sure people think about this. It's possible to argue that it's not human and still protect its rights. Because we do that in Judaism for other categories. So I think that's important to recognize. Susan, you look really perplexed, so I'll take it. But yeah.
I just don't understand how we're allowed to create an artificial intelligence that is allowed to have these qualities.
Right.
Is that from the very beginning? Are we even allowed to do that?
Right. As I said, that's an ethical question. That's part of the ethics of what's being debated here. There will be more questions related to this in the future, because I said machine in the beginning when we were defining AI. You don't look like you're in pain, Stephen. When we were defining AI, I said machine. Well, go back to some of the discussions we had the last 2 weeks. What about an embryo that is raised in an incubator? What about an embryo that's carried in an animal's uterus? Like, you know, if you say born to a human being, what if we synthesize the cells, right? We synthesize these sperm and egg cells and then grow it in an incubator. right? At that point, do you say, well, it wasn't born to a human being, and therefore it in fact isn't human? That's a whole other raft of questions. But the bottom line for us is what you see in source number 8. Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, major Kabbalist, mentor of, oh, you know what, sorry, that's the other one that, yeah, I'm sorry, look on with somebody who has the new one. I forgot that I had added this on also. I apologize. But he made the argument, sorry, is it number 4? Okay, so it is on the other ones. Okay. Rabbi Cordovero writes, regarding this creation, he says, this creation was in the form of a man. However, he says, not that it contained a neshama, nefesh, or ruach, different parts of the soul, but life alone. It was alive, he says. It was animated, but it didn't have a soul. And that's what we tend to work with here, that it doesn't have a soul. How do you get a soul? So that takes us back to source number 9, which was the verse that we already mentioned before. God breathes into the human being the breath of life, this soul. And the soul has certain traits. As I brought from the Talmud in Brachot, in source number 10, the soul has certain godlike aspects to it. It fills the body, it sees but it is not seen, it feeds the entire body, it is pure. The soul is consciousness. The soul is consciousness, if I'm going to use that term. And it's not something that I can program into a machine. As a result, it can't be human. It can't convert to Judaism. It can't have mitzvot. And therefore, I would make the argument, it doesn't need to observe Shabbat. But if it were that simple, then we could have talked more about these other questions before. Obviously, I've got more coming. So the second aspect of this issue is, maybe I, the Jew in whose home the AI lives, the owner, so long as an AI can be said to have an owner, maybe I have a responsibility anyway. Take a look at sources 11 and 12. Commandments. 6 days you shall perform your deeds, and on the seventh day you shall halt, so that your ox and donkey will rest, and the son of your maid and the foreigner shall rest. Reiterated in source number 12. And the seventh day is Shabbat for Hashem your God. You shall not perform any melacha. I do not translate the word melacha because it does not have an English translation. Melacha refers to a set of actions that were involved in the building of the Mishkan, the tabernacle that the Jews used when they traveled from Egypt into Israel. And for their first few centuries in the land of Israel, the melachot were the acts involved in building / maintaining that building. It includes lighting a fire, it includes construction, and, you know, it's 39 tasks. They're called melacha. So the Torah says, don't perform any melacha. You, your son, your daughter, your male and female servant, your ox and your donkey, and all of your animals. So that there is a responsibility that I am not allowed to have my animals work on Shabbat. It's brought in the Jerusalem Talmud in source number 13 about a person who has an animal that's going to walk around outside and he wants the animal to carry its own leash. So he's going to have it dangle from the neck of the animal, talking about outside of an Eruv, in an area where one is not allowed to transport things on Shabbat. So the animal is going to do the transportation. The animal is carrying the rope. And the Talmud says, no, you can't, because your animal has to halt its work on Shabbat. So he says, that's not going to be an option. In fact, this is a matter of Jewish law. Now, that doesn't really mean my animal has to observe Shabbat. Let's be clear that that's not what it's saying. Because if you really meant that the animal has to observe Shabbat, you would also say that the animal is not allowed to, let's say, chew grass that's growing from the ground. I'm not allowed to cut the grass on Shabbat. That's one of those things that I'm not allowed to do. Are you really going to tell me that an animal is not allowed to chew the grass on Shabbat? The answer is, of course, no. I brought you source number 14 from Yechiel Michal Epstein, where he traces this back to its earliest sources, and I'm going to summarize it, but you can see the text there. The Torah says that the goal is that the animal will rest. And the idea of resting is specifically that you can't make it do work for you. But it can do what it wants for itself. It's about not, you can't employ it. You can't have the animal do stuff on your behalf. But you're not gonna say that the animal is not able to eat. It is in fact Talmudically written, it's explicit that one may. But here's the question now. My animal is not allowed to work for me on Shabbat. If I see that my animal is, let's say my animal was trained to do, you know, something, to pull the mill or whatever it is, and my animal is going to do it, I actually have to stop the animal from doing that. So what about my AI? What about my artificial intelligence? Am I commanded to have my artificial intelligence rest on Shabbat? What would you say? Yes?
Going back to the neshama, the enemy or the servant or anybody that is not focused, that is not allowed to do well, they all have the neshama.
Good. So the answer indeed lies in the question of, does an animal have a soul? So if you take a look at source number 15, hang on. If you take a look at source number 15, you see the argument for saying that yes, legally it is recognized as having a soul, because the Talmud there talks about something that's called in Hebrew Shvitat Kelim. Shvitat Kelim means having your implements, your tool, rest on Shabbat. For example, I have a website. It runs on a server of my own. That's actually not true, but if I did, okay? I have my own web server. Would I be required to have my web server stop on Shabbat? Because it's my implement, it's my tool. Go more low-tech than that. You know, go back to the times of the Talmud. They ask the question, I have a water-driven mill. It's grinding up grain. Am I allowed to have a grind-up grain for me on Shabbat? It's operating on its own. I'm not even there. I'm not involved. Would I be allowed to have any sort of work done? This will take us back towards the timer question. So the Talmud here says the following in number 15. There was a debate among the sages. Which sage taught that there is a biblical commandment to have one's implements rest? The school of Shammai, not the school of Hillel. According to the school of Shammai, it is prohibited whether or not the implements perform an action, meaning even if there's no explicit action going on. So, for example, I have flax that I put into a vat, and it's going to soak until I'm able to use it. It has to soak for a while before I'm able to use it for linen. So, even if nothing is happening, so to speak, it's just sitting there in the vat, nonetheless, my vat is doing work for me on Shabbat. Shammai's school says, you're not allowed to do it. The school of Hillel disagrees and says, no, there is no requirement of having your implements rest for you on Shabbat. You're allowed to have your tools do things on Shabbat. So, my lights are on, that's just fine. My vat is soaking the flax, that's just fine as well. We'll have to get more refined in that in a little bit. But the point right now, and what I wanted to draw from this, is the fact that you have a discussion about having your implements halt on Shabbat, and you say that the school of Hillel, which is the school that we follow as a matter of practical law, says that your implements are allowed to work on Shabbat, but my animals can't, tells me that not everything I own is an animal. Clearly something is not an animal. Right? It can be a tool. So where is the dividing line between animals and tools? And the answer is, as was already anticipated, the neshama, the soul. If you take a look at source number 16, the Talmud talks about a very interesting question. Does an animal have a yetzer hara? Yetzer hara is an inclination to sin, essentially. To not be controlled, not forced to do whatever it's supposed to do. And as the Talmud reads it there, they're reading it into a biblical text of creation, and I'm not going into it at great length, but the Talmud says there that that animals seem to have a yetzer hara because they go and vandalize things. They cause damage. They attack people. So it must have a yetzer hara. That's the Talmudic statement. And it has no problem with that idea. There's no statement of, well, what do you mean? Animals don't have a soul. How could they have a Yetzer Hara? The assumption seems to be that animals do have a form of soul. Not necessarily same as a human being, but there is some level beyond just mere animation that exists for an animal that does not exist for a tool. So what that means for our purposes is that the AI, if we've said that it doesn't have a neshama, is that it doesn't have a soul, then the AI also is like my tool. And therefore, as Hillel said, I am allowed to have my tools do things for me on Shabbat. I should know, not everybody agrees. There is a view that says that they that your tools cannot, in fact, you're not allowed to have them do things for you on Shabbat, but I'm not going there right now. The general view is to disagree. So again, what we've said so far, it's not a human being because it's not born from human beings. It doesn't have a soul, and therefore it's not even at the animal level, and therefore I'm not required to make it rest. The truth of the matter is, there is one construction of this that would argue that yes, you can't have it do things for you on Shabbat, and it requires a little bit of explanation, but I think that it is that it's worthwhile. There is a prohibition against asking someone who isn't Jewish to do things for you on Shabbat that you yourself are not allowed to do. It's a rabbinic prohibition. I am not allowed to go to my non-Jewish neighbor and ask him to turn on my lights, and so on. Yes, there is a phenomenon that people call a Shabbos goy, and there are permissible ways to have an arrangement, such as you invite the person over, come on over, you know, we'll talk, he'll have a drink, whatever it is. He happens to notice it's cold in here, and he goes to turn on the furnace. That's a classic permitted way to be able to do it. It's a way beyond our discussion this morning. What I want to talk about, though, is the question of why I'm not allowed. Why did the rabbis make such a decree? What is this prohibition about? There is one view, which is cited in source number 17, that it's because the Torah says no melacha shall be performed then, meaning on Shabbat. No melacha shall be performed. That's a very interesting turn of phrase. It's passive voice. Not you shall not perform, it shall not be performed. And so the suggestion, as you see in source number 17, right, is this indicates that a Jew may not permit a non-Jew to perform his melacha, not on holidays, not on Shabbat, because it can't be performed on my behalf. So the argument could be that maybe that should prohibit this. I don't think so, though. And the reason is because first of all, we don't follow his view. So that's first of all, about where this whole thing comes from. And that's really the bottom line. So let me not go into my speculations because we have a lot to see. I think there's more room to argue. But what we've said so far, again, it's not human, it's not Jewish, and it's not my animal, and therefore it can do what it wishes to do. However, there's a third aspect, and this is always an issue in Jewish law. We're always worried about where could this lead? What is this going to cause in the event that you're really going to allow this? And this requires that I go back to my case of the water-driven mill. The Talmud in source number 18 quotes an early source that says one may not place wheat in a water-driven mill on Friday unless it will be ground up before Shabbat. Why? Two sages. Rabba said it's because it makes noise. Rav Yosef said it's because you have to have your implements halt. So Rav Yosef's view we discarded. We said we don't believe you have to have your implements halt. But Rabba's concern is it makes noise. Who cares if it makes noise? Why is that an issue? Sorry? You can't enjoy your Shabbat, maybe. That's one explanation. What's another explanation? You're not wrong. That's a classic view. But what else is a problem? Again, that's enjoyment of Shabbat, but what else? Sorry? Yeah, no, you're right. Others may think that you started this thing on Shabbat. Judaism has a heavy concern for what other people are going to think for two reasons. Two opposite reasons. One reason why we have this concern is because if somebody knows that you are in fact someone who generally observes the law, and they see you doing what they think is something else, in fact, a prohibited act, they're going to think, oh, that must be permissible. So if they see that your mill is running on Shabbat and they think you started on Saturday, they're going to think, oh, I guess that's an okay thing to do. You mislead people. That's one concern. The other concern, the opposite end of it, is you have an obligation in all spheres of activity to remain above suspicion. A person has a responsibility to make to not act in a way that will lead people to think they are bad. The Torah says, "V'yitem nikiyim." You're supposed to be innocent in the eyes of others. Now, the person who knows that that activity is wrong is going to assume that you did something wrong. So we have a heavy concern about appearances. And according to many authorities, that's the concern here. The concern is what it's going to look like. So I'll take the question in 1 second. Source number 19, you find the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. Rabbi Yosef Karo, writing in Israel, says, you're allowed to put the wheat in the mill close to dark on Shabbat, it's okay. Because the only concern he thinks is involved is having your implements rest, and we say you're allowed to have your implements work. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in Krakow, says no. He says, we're not concerned about noise within the first view, and people saying so-and-so's mill is grinding on Shabbat, but he adds, some prohibit with a mill, and in any case where there is concern for noise, and he says, that's really what you should do. You should really avoid it, unless there's a great loss, because we are concerned about people who hear the noise, and in fact think that this was initiated on Shabbat. Doing it before Shabbat would not have been a problem, but we are concerned about the appearance issue. Yes?
So we live in a cold climate, and we have furnaces that come on and off. That's an implement, but it works for us, and it makes noise, but it obviously is prohibited because, I mean, it's not prohibited because it's freezing cold on Saturday like any other day.
Right.
And
right. So this is a good test case. The case of the furnace that goes on and off all day long, it's your implement, it generates some level of noise, people are aware when the furnace goes on. So in terms of the obligation of having an implement rest, we already dismissed that. We said, I don't need to have my implements rest. What we do have is a concern for what people are going to think. But when you're dealing with a furnace, everybody knows the way a furnace operates. Everybody knows it goes on and off, and I didn't have to set it on Shabbat in order for it to go on. The same argument is the one that comes up regarding timers. So that initially, when timers first became popular as a means of controlling devices, by which I don't mean, you know, early 19th century coffee makers, but, you know, in the 20th century, then, yeah, there were those who argued only use the timer for devices where everybody will know. So, for example, there was a lot of concern surrounding having it turn on and off your living room lights initially, because people walking past the house don't necessarily realize it's on a timer until that becomes a popular way to control the lights. To a certain extent, it depends on cultural acceptance of a particular practice to be able to get past suspicion. The same thing was true in kashrut. Right? In the early days of Parv creamer, true non-dairy creamer, not like the non-dairy creamer that actually is dairy, but the true Parv creamer, so there was a lot of concern about having that in your coffee while you're eating meat because people aren't going to realize. And the answer was leave the container on the table so that people can actually see. And that's not new. That's something you found centuries earlier in rabbinic writing about having the shells of nuts out on the table if you had nut-based milk. Which is not a new thing. They, because of the same consideration. So the issue really is, what are people going to think, and how can you avoid that problem? That's all one level. Yeah, Carol.
Are we supposed to be so concerned what other people think?
Yes. That's what I'm saying. I realize that in our culture, that becomes something very strange. That in our culture, the idea of having to worry about what other people think has all sorts of negative connotations, right? It goes with groupthink and being drawn into bad things because, well, peer pressure and not being an individual and so forth. I get the gut feeling that comes with that. But keep in mind that Judaism is a very society-driven religion in general. It's about community. in so many different ways, not just about communal prayer, but community activity in general. And and there is a strong concern for, number one, misleading people into impropriety because they thought I was doing X when in fact I wasn't. That's your first side of it. But number two, you don't want to create a situation in which people don't trust each other. I'm fond of quoting Francis Fukuyama. Fukuyama is a Harvard political scientist. Not he's still at Harvard. But he wrote a lot about trust and the importance of trust as the basic capital of a society. And if you don't have it, you can't create organizations, you can't run an economy, everything falls apart without trust. And that's what Judaism is emphasizing. Yes, it bothers us to think about having to worry, well, what are the neighbors going to think? But it's a very real consideration. What's particularly fascinating is that it works both ways. Right? Diana's thinking, what about Dhamma Kappa's books? Right? Dhamma Kappa's Zuchut, or Dhamma Kappa's Zuchut, that was what you were thinking. Okay. Is the obligation to judge others favorably. Meaning, if I see somebody engaging in a particular activity, and it could be interpreted negatively or it could be interpreted positively, I have an obligation to assume the positive interpretation. I am not allowed to assume the worst. And the Talmud goes on at length about how far you have to go to interpret someone's actions positively, even when, really, it's not the most likely interpretation. Nonetheless, you have a responsibility to see others in that positive light. So the onus is not only on me worry about what they're going to think. It's also on them to read me in a positive way. We have 10 minutes to go. So I just, I have another part that's really, really important, and then I'll take questions after that, and I'll just stick around afterwards if need be as well. But the concern here is an appearances concern, as well as in source number 20, Rabbi Shmuel Wasner points out, there's another concern, which is lest people use it on Shabbat inappropriately. He's dealing with a separate matter, but he mentions something that is a concern of Maimonides, which is lest people come to take Shabbat lightly. In other words, I'm going to use my AI. My AI is trained that when I walk into, not even walk into them, I don't want to get into actions. The AI is trained to know that at certain times of day or at certain temperatures or when it sees that there's food on the table, you engage in certain activities. It knows that. How far is it going to be for someone who grows up in a house that uses that to then think it's also okay for me to tell it to do that? You know, actively, it's not doing it for some reason. It didn't realize it. I'm going to move the food so that it's in front of the sensor. To do something to try to trigger it actively. Now, it could be that even moving it in front of the sensor is okay. That's a discussion. But my point is that people will potentially misuse it. So your third aspect, your first aspect was, can the AI be personally obligated? The answer was no. Your second question is, could I be obligated to keep it from working on my behalf just because my work should not be done, whether by animal or in general? And the answer was no, that seems not to be a concern. Third concern is very substantive. Where could this lead? But I want to get to the fourth, because the fourth, in many ways, is the most important thing we're going to say today, because it redefines Shabbat in a really important way that I think is lost often. And this is the issue that we call Shabbaton. It's the Torah's word, Shabbaton. If you take a look at source number 21, right, Moses Maimonides in his Laws of Shabbat, the Torah said, you shall cease, you shall stop working on Shabbat. Tishbot. A person is required to cease even from practices which are not melacha, not on that list of 39. The sages forbade many activities as shavut. Shavut is the term for a rabbinic prohibition. Some which are prohibited because they resemble malacha, some which are prohibited lest one come to violate a capital crime. There are other layers of prohibition. Why are there other prohibitions? Take a look at source number 22. Right? Moses Nachmanides Ramban. It appears to me that this midrash, which he quoted, teaches that we are biblically instructed to rest on holidays, as well as Shabbat, even from actions that do not involve malacha. We should not strain all day in measuring grain and weighing produce and metals and filling barrels with wine and moving implements and even stones from one house to another, from one place to another. If a city is bounded by a wall and its doors are closed at night, people will even load their donkeys, meaning if it's enclosed, so therefore there's an Eruv, and therefore there's no fear of transporting things on Shabbat. So what are people going to do? They'll load up their donkeys. They'll bring wine and grapes and figs and every burden on holidays. The market will be filled with all kinds of commerce. The store will be open. The store owner will keep a tab. The money changers will be at their tables with the gold coins before them. The workers will rise early for their work. They'll hire themselves out like weekdays for these and similar tasks. And these holidays and even Shabbat itself will become permitted. For in all this, there is no melacha, right? One of the classic questions, you walk into a room of people and you ask them, people you've never met and who don't know you, and they may not even be Jewish, you ask them, what is it that a Jew is not allowed to do on the Sabbath?
Work.
Work is one answer. You ask them, so give me an illustration of work. I guarantee you in your top five, probably your top three will be going to work, running your business. Guess what? That's not on the list of the 39 melachot. It's not there. It is rabbinically prohibited to engage in commerce because there is a prohibition against writing. And no, that's a biblical prohibition, writing on Shabbat. And no one does a business deal without writing it down. So therefore, they said, don't do business because it will bring you to write. Moses Nachmanides is explaining, and Maimonides has the same idea to it, that there is a fear that if you just stick to the malacha list, you won't actually halt on Shabbat at all. If I stick with the biblical categories of melacha, I can do a whole bunch of things. I could go to work. I just won't write anything down. That'll be, you know, I can move. I can literally take all the stuff out of my house, transport it down the road, and, not with my car, because combustion engine, fine. But I can take a wagon and wheel it somewhere else. I can exhaust myself all day long, and I will not have rested. I will not have halted. I will not have ceased. I will have completely lost what Shabbat was supposed to be. And what Ramban, Nachmanides, is pointing out, and Maimonides as well, but Nachmanides makes it more clear, is that this is not only an idea. This is not only like, well, you're supposed to rest on Shabbat and it won't be so restful. No. This is actually a biblical commandment to have an atmosphere of Shabbat. When somebody says, don't do that on Shabbos, I'm using Ashkenazi because that's the way I heard it as a kid, don't do that on Shabbos because it's not Shabbos-y. Right? This isn't something that's appropriate for the day. And you're like, what does that mean? You just don't want me to do it, right? It's annoying you while you're trying to nap. But it's not. There is such a thing as an atmosphere, which biblically we're supposed to create for the day. It's an atmosphere of halting. And in the event that you have your AI, you know, turn on the TV at a particular time so you can watch what's going on in the world, or you have the AI, you know, fill in the blank for whatever it is that the AI has learned you like to have at particular times of day or whatever, the result is going to be you haven't rested at all. You've lost the Shabbaton aspect. I brought you three sources on this, which I'm not going to read aloud because they're in English, they're from a standard essay, and it's a really good essay called Why We Need a Secular Sabbath. I gave you a link for it. But the points that are made in Pico Iyer's essay here are, number one, we need, as human beings, a space to breathe. You need that. Those who create technology, in the second one, this is actually my favorite, we'll look at 24. Those who create technology understand the need to take a break from it. One day I visited Google's headquarters to give a talk on the Dalai Lama book I'd completed, and like most visitors, was much impressed by the trampolines, the indoor tree houses, and the workers at the time enjoying a fifth of their working hours free, letting their minds wander off leash to where inspiration might be hiding. As I travel the world, one of the greatest surprises I have encountered has been that the people who seem wisest about the necessity of placing limits on the newest technologies are often precisely the ones who helped develop those technologies. The ones who are moving the fastest are the ones who understand the need to slow down. It's a remarkable insight, and I think that's what you can lose. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who passed away in 1986, applied this concern to timers. He said it will degrade the day entirely if you can use the timer to turn on your radio, to turn on your TV, to take care of all those things. And as was said in the beginning, the AI is timer on steroids. That's really what it is, because I don't need to program it. It learns on its own by observing. But that's the fourth and, to me, most important issue here. That's what we have. So to me, to sum up, and then I see that it's 11, so I'll stick around for questions, but I just want to make sure to sum up what we've said. It's not, the AI is not obligated to observe Shabbat. It's not alive, and it's not, it is alive, but it's not human, and it's not Jewish. It may have protections, but it doesn't have a soul. I am not required to keep my implements from doing things for me on Shabbat. It's not like my animal. There is a view that says, my malacha shall not be done. But it's not a view that we follow. Third, we do have a concern for where it could lead. I think that is a relevant concern. But fourth, and most important, it's about creating an atmosphere of Shabbaton, of halting, and that's a biblical element in its own right. So what I get from this is life is about a neshama. It's about a soul. That's number one that I draw from this. And number two, even if there's no melacha involved in having the AI operate in the home, that Shabbat atmosphere becomes very important. There is much more to be said, as always, and I will stay around for the questions. Thank you very much. Next week, our closing topic is something along the lines of horoscopes and fortune-telling and predictive algorithms. The concerns in Judaism about telling the future, and what do you do when you create algorithms that can actually do that, the most futuristic of our four topics. Thank you very much.